Good evening or good morning, wherever you are in the world. Hello and welcome to Blogging Theology. I'm sure most of our viewers will know who Dr. Ehrman is, but in case some do not, I'll just mention that Dr. Ehrman is an American New Testament scholar focusing on textual criticism of the New Testament, the historical Jesus, and the origins and development of early Christianity. He's written and edited over 30 books, including 3 college textbooks, and is currently the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in the USA. You are most welcome to Blogging Theology, Dr. Ehrman.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. And I understand I can call you Bart from here on,
yes,
so
please.
I will. Thank you. Now, Bart has kindly agreed to discuss with us 3 areas. First is Jesus and the Gospels. Secondly, textual criticism of the Bible. And thirdly, the Christianities after the New Testament. So without any more ado, we'll jump into the first subject, which is Jesus and the Gospels. And I would like to ask you, Bart, if I can, what are the reasons most scholars date the 4 canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, to about AD 70 to 100? Well, what are the reasons they have for that, or you have for that?
Yeah, well, those are pretty much the accepted dates. There are different scholars have different views, of course, and there are some people who I would say conservative evangelicals tend to date them earlier, maybe before 70, and there's a big movement now to think about the Gospel of Luke as much later, like in the 120s or something. And so there are a variety of opinions, but the reason for the dates is almost everybody agrees that Mark was the first gospel. Because it's, if you actually do a careful linguistic analysis of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's pretty clear that Matthew and Luke both used Mark as one of their sources. And almost everybody has always agreed that John is the last gospel. And so usually Mark's thought to be first, John's thought to be last. Scholars for a very long time have thought that Mark was written around or just after the year 70. And in part that's because he appears to know that the city of Jerusalem has fallen and that the temple's been destroyed because of the contents of especially of Mark chapter 13, but for other reasons as well. I mean, for one thing, the only earlier writings we have of that from Mark would be the writings of Paul, and Paul, who's well traveled, doesn't seem to know anything about existing gospels and doesn't say anything about them, and so it looks like maybe he didn't know about these gospels, and so usually it's thought these things are later, and so around 70 makes sense. Matthew and Luke dated somewhat later because they both used Mark, and they show even clearer knowledge of knowing about the destruction of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And then John is the last gospel. It's the most theologically developed gospel. It appears to many people to have originated in some kind of different community with different Christological views. It seems to presuppose situations later in the first century. And so it's usually dated to around 90 or 95. And so these things are, you know, there's some speculation involved, but it's a lot of educated guessing, and it's where most people come down.
Yeah. You mentioned the highly developed theology of the last gospel, and thus dating it quite late. But is it not the case that Paul also has quite highly developed theology, a Christology, and understanding who Jesus was? And he's really early. I mean, you say he predates the gospel. So
right.
How much of that is a reliable indicator of chronology, given Paul's high theology and John's theology, both opposite ends of the scale?
Yeah, it's not. I wouldn't say it's a decisive indicator at all. Even in the early church, going back to Clement of Alexandria, people talked about John as being the last gospel to be written, and it is more theologically developed. Paul's a very interesting case in point because Paul, of course, is writing earlier, and especially in his letter to the Philippians in chapter 2, where he quotes that poetic section about Christ, who he portrays Christ as a pre-existent divine being who comes down, in my reading of it, it's the typical reading of it, who pre-existent divine being who comes to earth as a human and then gets exalted back up into heaven. The interesting thing about Paul's Christology is that he understands Christ both to be somebody who became a human, but then also who is exalted more highly after his resurrection. And John doesn't have it that way. John is more strictly an incarnational understanding that 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 Christ is a pre-existent divine being who came down and then just returned to what he was before.
You mentioned about Philippians, it's slightly off topic, but John, Philippians chapter 2, about this, the Jesus becoming human and so on. But is it not the case at the very end, Paul kind of ends it with the doxology, to the glory of God the Father? So is it not the case that God still remains God, Yahweh, if you like, and so Jesus isn't identified as God in that sense, although he is exalted to the highest possible level, maybe even equality with God, but ontologically he's not identified as that being. Would that be reasonable?
I would say that's right, that he's not. Yeah. So for some reason, people have started, I don't know how far back this goes, I've just recently heard of people saying that Jesus is Yahweh, and I think, not in the New Testament, no, not in the Bible, but certainly not here, because God, so he's a separate being from God. To begin with, Jesus is in the form of God. Even though he was in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God something to be grasped. This is a very complicated verse because of the Greek.
Yeah.
And it's not clear whether it means it's not something he wanted to hold on to or if it wasn't something he wanted to reach for. And I think the word, the Greek word, mortimus, means to reach.
Is it morphe that means form in Greek?
He's in the morphe tuthau, form of God. And he didn't regard equality with God, the esos word, something to be grasped. And grasp is harpazo, which means to grab something. And I think what it's saying is that before he became a human, he was in a divine form. He was a divine being, but he wasn't equal with God. No. But at the end, God highly exalts him and gives him the name above every name.
All other names.
So that at the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess. That's taken out of Isaiah, which said this is about Yahweh, that to him only will every knee bow and every tongue confess. So it looks like he's made him on a some kind of equal level.
Is it more honorary then for Paul than ontological? It's not like a metaphysical reality. It's kind of he's exalted that position rather than having that by right for all eternity.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He's not metaphysically. I mean, Paul wouldn't use these terms, of course.
No,
metaphysically God, but God has made him an equal. At least in terms of human worship goes for Paul. And that coincides with what you get elsewhere in Paul, like in 1 Corinthians 15, where Christ, everything is subject to Christ, and then he subjects everything to God. There's still this kind of almost a subordination. And later, theologians wouldn't want to talk about subordinationism, but there is that kind of leveling, I think.
So Paul, that's very helpful. Thank you for that clarification. Just coming back to earth a bit more. My next question was about the many predictions we read in particularly the earlier Gospels, the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, of Jesus's death and resurrection. And almost at random, there's a very clear example in Luke chapter 8, verses 31, where Jesus says, he tells his disciples that everything written about the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished. He'll be handed over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and insult him and spat on him. Then they'll flog him. And after they've killed him, on the third day, he will rise again. And this is one example and sometimes very detailed predictions. But the question is, in terms of the astonishment that is then shown by the disciples, the very same people in Luke 24, when the women come back from the tomb, they say, look, he's not there, he's risen. And Peter, I forget the Greek word, but seems to be saying, you don't talk nonsense, you're talking nonsense. I mean, did the historical Jesus, my question is this, did the historical Jesus, therefore, really, I mean, supernaturalist issues apart, because you can still predict your death and, just be human, if you like, you don't have to have supernatural knowledge. Did Jesus really predict his death and resurrection, or is this a retrospectively inserted idea put in the Gospels to tidy up a narrative which otherwise would be a bit unprovidential, shall we say?
That's exactly the issue, and it's I think you usually scholars look at the specificity of those predictions and say, this really, if you if you're pretty sure that early Christians are telling stories about Jesus and sometimes changing stories and sometimes changing the way he says things and sometimes putting words on his lips, which Christians definitely were putting words on his lips. And we have gospels from early Christianity where Jesus says all sorts of things that nobody thinks he really said. I mean, Christians are doing this. And so the question is, which things are they putting on his lips? This is one of the first things to go, I think, from the gospels, because the specificity of this, and especially predicting his own resurrection, I think is a clear indication that this is something that's later put on his lips. It does create this delicious irony, though, that you actually get it first in Mark, of course, the first gospel, where Jesus makes three explicit passion predictions, and the disciples simply don't get it. and a lot of that not getting it stuff gets mitigated a bit in Matthew and in Luke, but there are elements of it still remaining where they just don't, you know, they're not expecting the resurrection, even though Jesus is spending his, in Luke, he makes four of these predictions, and then they still think that the women are crazy, because what are you talking about? And the reader, of course, is saying, yeah, well, he's been saying it all along. But so
just to clarify, the reason that historians are skeptical is not because of some alleged anti-supernaturalist liberal bias, it's because the story doesn't make sense. And so it looks as if, you know, they may have been tampering with the story. Is that a fair assessment?
I'd say it's a combination of things. I think it's that we know that the Christians are putting things on Jesus' lips. There are things that Christians would like Jesus to say. Mm-hmm. We know we've got these very, very specific predictions. You can imagine Jesus knowing that his time is up and saying, I'm going to be arrested and killed. But when you look at what's specifically, and then you're right, the whole story doesn't make sense anymore then, because mm-hmm. he keeps telling the disciples this, and you know, either they were idiots or they weren't listening, or somebody's like, you know,
Luke says, and not just Luke, he says, their understanding, they were kept from understanding, as if Jesus told them this and then they were prevented by God or someone from understanding. Well, what was the whole point of them telling him in the first place? Are they going to have the understanding taken away from them? Never quite understood that. Okay. Now, there's a big question. Did Jesus think he was God? And how do we establish this on an historical basis? Because I'm not asking historians to look inside the mind of a man from 2,000 years ago in downtown Palestine. But in terms of the evidence, how could we possibly know if Jesus thought he was God or not? What would be the indicators, do you think?
Well, I would say, you know, technically, of course, you can't know. You can't know what anybody thinks. You know, I don't know what you think about yourself. You don't know what I think about. We're talking to each other. So, and, you know, with Jesus, we're speaking of somebody who's, you know, 2,000 years ago. We don't have any recorded words from him that he wrote. And so we only have later. And so we have to base it on what he's recorded as saying and determining what the things that he's recorded as saying are things that he probably really said. Mm. So most historians think that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as our earliest gospels, are they're closer to the time. They're based on older sources. Matthew and Luke both had some other source that your hearers might know about, the Q source, which is a source of sayings of Jesus that would have been available to Matthew and Luke. Dates before them, maybe before Mark, I don't know. They have other sources of information. Matthew has some of his own sources for sayings that are only in Matthew. Luke has sources for sayings in Luke. And so you've got at least, for the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, at least you've got Mark, Q, M, and L, which are these four sources. Yeah. It's really interesting when you read these four sources, Jesus never calls himself God in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And so it means he never calls himself a God in Mark, Q, M, or L. People say, well, yeah, but he does things that show that he's God. And that, you know, so, yeah, you do get these stories in the Gospels that you have to take into account. But if you ask, what did he say about himself? The only place he calls himself, or he doesn't actually quite call himself God, but he describes himself as a divine being only in the Gospel of John, our last Gospel. And I think historically that's very interesting because if it's true that Jesus was going around saying that he was God, he's telling his disciples, he's telling people that he actually is God come to earth. If that were the case, how is it that three of our gospels don't mention it? Mm-hmm. I mean, you would think this would be a rather important point. And of all of his teachings, this would be the one you'd want it, but they don't say it. And so that's why most critical scholars suspect that this is a view that develops later and that you find in the Gospel of John, but it's not historically something that Jesus himself was saying.
Okay, that's very clear. Dr. Dale Martin, who I've had the privilege of speaking to on several occasions, I know he's a friend of yours, has said in his view, one of the most securely, historically reliable passages in the Synoptic Gospels is the passage found in Mark 10, verses 17, 18, and 19. A man comes to Jesus and says, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus says, "Why do you call me good? There is no one good but God alone. Obey the commandments," etc. And the reason seems to be that here we have an apparent denial by Jesus on the lips of Jesus in Mark. I know it's slightly different in Matthew, that he is in any way identifying himself as God or as a divine being. You know, why do you call me good? There's no one good but God alone. Now, do you share, if I can put it in this personal way, do you share Dale's confidence that this is a very reliable episode in the Gospels?
Yeah, we've had a number of arguments about these verses. Dale Martin and I.
Okay.
We do agree. We both agree that this does look like something that's historical that Jesus said.
Right.
And it actually is important that Matthew changes it.
Yes.
Because Matthew changes it so Jesus no longer says what he says in Mark. So in Mark, the man comes up to him and says, "Good teacher, what must I have for eternal life? And why do you call me good? God alone is good." In Matthew, you have the word good still, but it puts in a different place. In Matthew, Matthew, the man comes up to Jesus and says, "Teacher, what good thing must I do for eternal life?" So he uses good, but now it's not applied to Jesus. It's applied to the thing he has to do.
Yep.
And it ends up making nonsense of what Jesus replies, because then Jesus replies, "Why do you ask me about the good?
Well, you're the Messiah. You should know about these things."
So anyway, but in Mark, he does say this. The argument that Dale Martin and I have had about it is, what is Jesus denying?
Right.
When he says, why do you call me good? God alone is good. Dale thinks that's a denial that he's God. And I think he might be right about that. I think that's a very good way of reading it. But another way of reading it is that he's denying being good. Why do you call me good? Mm-hmm. Only God is good. So it might, those two things might kind of gel together.
Yeah. If he's a humble Jew, you know, he's not glorifying himself. He's saying, look, why do you call this word only really belongs in its true significance with God himself. He's being very humble. It doesn't mean that he's a terrible sinner or he's saying, oh, I'm a bad person. Yeah. He's just saying, use that language of God. Maybe there's some spiritual, pious motif there or something.
Yeah, it could be, and so I think it might be a denial that he's God, but it's not a cut and dried case for me.
So if Jesus is not denying he's God, that what would be the motive in Matthew changing the words of Jesus then to remove that? Well, what's Matthew removing? Is it just the sense that Jesus is being denying he's good? Then I suppose.
Yeah, it's one or the other. It's either that Matthew's or both. But Matthew doesn't like the idea that Jesus is somehow claiming either not to be good or not to be God or possibly both. And so he changes it. Luke keeps it, but you know Matthew had a problem with it.
Matthew, one of the things you have said, I've noticed, if I've understood you correctly, on videos I've seen, is that you state that, in John's gospel, Jesus is clearly called God in some sense, but he's also called God in some sense in Matthew, Mark, and Luke as well. And that, I suspect, is often misunderstood by some people to mean that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all saying Jesus is God in the Christian sense. And is it, maybe you want to say something about the way language of divinity was used in the ancient Greco-Roman world and even within Judaism, when even human beings can be addressed as Theos, for example, Psalm 45, as you know, in the Dead Sea Scrolls and in other places in the Bible, that this was a title could be used perhaps in a more honorific sense or symbolic or figurative. It wasn't necessarily in the harder metaphysical sense of this person is Yahweh, if you see what I mean. When we map our own preconceptions on this terrain, we end up thinking that you're saying that Mark, for example, who's just had Jesus deny that he's good or God, nevertheless, Mark also believing that he is Yahweh. And you're not quite saying that, are you?
No, I'm definitely not saying that. I don't think any early Christian thought Jesus was Yahweh. I mean, I think you know, this is this modern construct. I'm not sure where people come up with this, but it's not in the Bible. It's a very complicated question because I do think that Matthew, Mark, and Luke do think that Jesus is God in some sense, but the issue is in what sense? And the problem we have. So, you know, I wrote a book called How Jesus Became God, where I had to deal with this whole thing. And it took a long time to deal with this question because it's there. It is.
Okay,
there
you read it, folks. You can buy it now through Amazon. Worth a read. Yeah.
So there are several things going on here. And so let me just talk about two kind of things that are going on. One is in antiquity generally, among Greeks, Romans, Jews, Christians, in the kind of the Western world, there are understandings of what divinity is that are different from today's understandings. Today, when people think about God, they think about this transcendent being who is so far beyond anything for us that there's God up here and there's us down here and there's this chasm and there's no, like, you know, it's like we're just peons and God is God. But in the ancient world, in all these belief systems, it was the divine world was more like a pyramid where you have different levels of divinity. And so in Greek and Roman religion, for example, often there will be some kind of head god who's the head person. But then below that god, there'll be like the gods of Mount Olympus, very famous gods of the myths. And below them will be the gods of the cities and the towns and the streams and the forests and the meadows. And then below them, there'll be these other lower level daimonia. And there's this level of thing. And there can even be humans that are kind of semi-divine. At the very bottom of this pyramid. And so Jews held that view as well. So that in Judaism, you have Yahweh, but then below Yahweh, you've got angels and archangels and principalities and powers and cherubim and seraphim. You got these other things. And Christianity also had that view that there are other divine beings. God is God. But it's possible for a human being to be made into a superhuman being, into a divine being in all of these religions. And the way it typically works in Greek, Roman, and Jewish faiths is that a person who's really, really righteous or there's something special about them. Like in Greek religion, it's because the person is like so incredibly powerful or so unbelievably beautiful or so incredibly smart. Like there's something like not human about them. They can be taken up to heaven at the end of their life to live with the gods, so they never die. They are made immortal. And in Greek and Roman religions, immortal is just another word for the gods. And so humans can be made divine beings. And even in Judaism, you get this, not in the Old Testament per se, but some passages might suggest this, but in apocryphal writings, you have beings who can be made into a divine, like Enoch can be made into a divine being, or Elijah. So the early Matthew, Mark, and Luke believe that Jesus got raised from the dead. And when he got raised from the dead, he didn't have a near-death experience. You know, he didn't just kind of come back for a few years and then die again. He was raised and taken up into heaven, which means he was made an immortal for them.
So that's the crucial point, the Christian belief in the resurrection. When he rose from the dead, ascended into heaven, at that point, and indeed Paul seems to suggest this perhaps at the beginning of Romans, at that point he was designated or became divine. Yeah. Is that what you're arguing?
Yeah. I think that's the earliest Christian belief. And I think it predates Paul. I think the earliest disciples of Jesus, when they believed in the resurrection, they didn't have, you know, in our minds, we have Jesus getting raised and then 40 days later going up to heaven. And we have that because of the book of Acts, the only place that narrates that. The earliest Christians appear to have thought that Jesus was raised, but he wasn't raised back to earth. He went up to heaven. And then he would come down, you know, make some appearances to show that it happened. But he was in heaven. And so he's a divine being. And so Mark would have no problem saying that Jesus is the Son of God and mean that he's actually, in some sense, a divine being. But it's not that he pre-existed, you know, and it's not that he was God become flesh. There's no incarnation in these books. It's that he was a human who was exalted and became a divine being.
I think it's a really important point there. Many scholars have noticed this in Luke's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 35, where the language in the Greek seems to suggest, or seems to exclude, I should say, any understanding. This is the virgin, so-called virgin birth story of Jesus in the womb of Mary, of course. It seems to exclude any understanding of incarnation. It seems to be that the Son, Jesus, this being, came into existence, not incarnation, but came into being itself. Yeah. Yeah. In the womb of Mary at that conception. So there's no pre-existence, no incarnation in Luke of all places. And Luke's identified, particularly in Catholic spirituality, as, you know, the gospel about Mary, you know, her great disciple. So is that do you go along with that there's no incarnation in Luke and in Matthew and in Mark?
I do agree with that, and I think that's the right reading of it. I think people get a little bit confused because if they're raised Christian, you know, if they're in the Anglican Church or the Catholic Church, and they say a creed, you know, and they talk about Christ coming down from heaven, being made incarnate through the Virgin Mary, you know, it sounds like it's all like the same thing. But but the incarnation is a doctrine found in John's Gospel, where there's no virgin birth. And the virgin birth is found in Matthew and Luke, where there's no incarnation. And so it's like it's combined these two. But the Luke passage is especially interesting. It's during the Annunciation, the angel Gabriel comes to Mary, and he says, you know, you're going to conceive. And she says, how? I have never had sex. And he says, the Holy Spirit shall come upon you. The power of the Most High shall overshadow you, so that the one born of you shall be called holy, the Son of God. In other words, the reason Jesus is the Son of God is because his mother's a virgin, and God is the one through the Spirit who gets her pregnant. So he's literally the Son of God. And so there's no incarnation here. This is him coming into being as the Son of God.
That's very remarkable. Okay, if we could we're still on Jesus and the Gospels. Our next subject would be textual criticism of the Bible. The last one with Jesus and the Gospels. It's to do with Jesus, the followers of Jesus, we've mentioned these already, and Paul. I mean, it seems to me, if you look at, say, the earliest disciples' family members, like James, the brother of Jesus. Jesus had a brother, according to our records, and he ended up heading up the church in Jerusalem, the Jerusalem church. Acts mentions him in passing. It seems to me that these folk were Jewish Christians. Obviously, they were Jews, who were Torah observant, who were good Jews, basically, you know, what we understand today by Jews, the temples that existed, and they went to the temple, and it says in Acts that they went to the temple at the hour of prayer to pray, which was the hour of sacrifice. It wasn't like a church where you go and just pray. It was had a function as a sacrificing temple. But to juxtapose that or contrast that, it seems to me, with Paul and the kind of Hellenistic Christian Gentiles, perhaps, associated with the churches he founded, were there any conflicts between these two that we can see historically, or they all agreed about Jesus' mission, Christology, law observance, and the whole thing, do you think?
You know, it completely depends on whether you read the book of Acts or if you read the letters of Paul. Because in the book of Acts, they are completely simpatico. They agree on everything. They have a council to decide everything. There's nothing to decide. They all agree. And Acts is really trying very hard to show that they are in agreement on everything. Paul tells a very different story, especially in his letter to the Galatians, where it's quite clear that he has disagreements with James and Peter. The disagreement is not about Christology, and in one sense, it's not really about soteriology. It's not about salvation per se. They all agree that Jesus' death and resurrection is what puts a person into a right standing before God. They all agree on that. What Peter and James think, though, is that for a person to be a follower of the Jewish Messiah, they have to be Jewish. In other words, I mean, Christ is the Jewish Messiah. He was sent from the Jewish God in fulfillment of the Jewish law to the Jewish people. And so if you're going to be a follower of the Jewish Messiah, you got to become a Jew, which means you've got to be a male, has to be circumcised. They have to eat kosher foods. And there was a range of opinions about this. Paul may have come up with this idea that, you know, he says that he was given his gospel by Christ, And I don't think he means by that that he was given the idea that Jesus died and was raised from the dead. People were saying that already. That's why Paul was persecuting people, is because Christians were saying the Messiah has been crucified and raised from the dead, and Paul thought they were nuts. So he got that. But at when he had his vision of Christ, whatever that was, the gospel that was revealed to him is that Jews and Gentiles can both be saved by the death and resurrection of Jesus, and they don't, the Gentiles don't have to be Jews. This was the revelation Paul got. And so Paul was quite insistent, Gentiles do not have to follow the Jewish law. I mean, he says that repeatedly in Romans and Galatians, but what he means by that apparently is that there are some things in the Jewish law that make Jews Jewish, like circumcision and kosher and Sabbath and things. Mm-hmm. There are other things that are just like, you know, you're not supposed to murder people. You're not supposed to commit adultery. Paul thought all that still applies. But Gentiles did not have to convert to Judaism. The issue came up that then, are Jews and Gentiles really the same? Are they equal? Or are Jews superior? Or can they really fellowship together? Because if they fellowship together, if Jews are hanging out with Gentiles, that means they're going to have to break their kosher laws. And so the Jews shouldn't associate in the church. That was James and Peter's view, apparently. And Paul really rejected that. So it's all about whether Jews and Gentiles are completely equal in Christ or not.
But what role does Torah observant then play for Jewish Christians in Paul's thought? It seems, I mean, I'm not an expert, at the end of Galatians, it looks like the Torah has been replaced by living according to the Spirit or following Christ or something. It doesn't seem that Torah observant is central anymore. And indeed, was it not the case that later on that century, in a Gentile-dominated church anyway, after the fall of Jerusalem, that Torah observance really became something of an anachronism, and now it was just focused on other things?
It's a complicated question because Paul never says. He never tells Jews to stop keeping the Torah. And he does say that he himself lived like a Jew when he was among Jews, which makes
and not when he wasn't, though. That's the point. He did say when he wasn't, he didn't follow it. Now, Jew would not follow the Torah, whatever circumstances they were in?
That's right. Paul does, when Paul, so he's a Jew among Jews and a Gentile among Gentiles, as he said in the first verse. And that means that he's not Torah observant in the way that most Jews would think of Torah observance. But it does mean that when he's among Jews, he is Torah observant, which makes me think that he thinks that Jews who are believers in Jesus, they're perfectly welcome to keep following the Torah. You know, if your ox gores the next door neighbor, you still got to do what the Torah says about it. But for the Jews, and it's, I don't think he doesn't condemn circumcision for Jews or kosher food laws for Jews. He says some do, some don't. Some Christian followers use, some do, some don't. I think he was fine with Jews keeping the Torah, but he did not think that put a Jew in a better standing with God. Keeping the Torah is not going to help your standing with God. If it did, you wouldn't need Jesus. And so since you got Jesus, you know, so I don't think that Paul was opposed to Torah observance. He was opposed to thinking that Torah observance mattered for salvation, which is a different thing. You know, at one point, a couple points in his letters, he tells his Gentile followers, including Galatians, that you should love your neighbor as yourself because love fulfills the law. That indicates that the law needs to be fulfilled. That's why you have to love one another. But it's not by doing these things that Jews do as their, you know, as their Torah observant customs.
But there are a couple of passages, surely, aren't there, in his letters, which suggest that, for example, the kosher laws, the food laws, this whole thing of clean and unclean food, that distinction has just been done away with now, that no food is unclean in itself, and thus you can eat it. And that would surely, wouldn't that be a direct abrogation of at least some parts of the Levitical laws? And in that sense, he was not upholding the Torah for everyone, because in Christ there is no clean or, you know, all these things are now possible.
I mean, it's hard, you know, as you know, there are very big books written on Paul and the law by scholars who spent 30 years thinking about it, and they disagree with each other.
This is what I found. I was an undergraduate. I was studying this. I was giving a long bibliography about this very issue, and you had all the views on the spectrum. I said, well, I'm supposed to make up my own mind. What's the answer, please? Oh, no, you've got to write the essay.
Okay. So I'll tell you my answer to it is that that Paul did not think that Torah observance would make a Jew right with God or would make a Gentile right with God. And if a Gentile started following the Torah, that meant that they thought that would make them right with God, which means they completely misunderstood that the God that salvation comes only through Christ. But I think that Paul had no problem with Jews keeping their customs. And then he saw Torah observance as a Jewish custom to make Jews Jewish. They're the chosen people. God gave them these rules. Of course, they should follow those. But, you know, it's got nothing to do with your salvation. So when he says that all things are, you know, if he says it's okay, you know, some people observe us today and other people don't. Some people say it's okay to eat things. Other people don't. You know, like that's not what really matters. I think he means for salvation. But it's perfectly fine for Jews to keep kosher. I mean, I think that's his view.
Yeah. So. Okay. And Jesus himself, of course, according to Matthew, anyway, his reading of the situation didn't really abrogate or abolish the laws. He has Jesus say, you know, I've not come to abolish the law. And, you know, not one jot or tittle of the law has been done away with. And initial righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees and the scribes. You will not blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then in Matthew 23, you know, he says the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat, do whatever they tell you and obey it, but don't do what they do because they're a bunch of hypocrites. He's not on message, is he, really, Matthew, when it comes to the gospel, if you compare him to Paul.
Well, yeah, he's not a message with Paul, that's for sure. I sometimes have told my students that, you know, I would be interested in having Paul and Matthew locked up in a room and not be allowed to emerge until they come up with a consensus view of the law.
I think
you'd find their skeletons in a death grip because but it's very interesting though, because Matthew's a complicated case because, you know, it's people always think of Matthew as Jewish and that he's talking to, and I don't know, but you know, when he does say you have to keep the law better than the scribes and the Pharisees and you have to keep jot and tittle and all of that, he goes on then to explain what he means in the antitheses.
Yeah.
And the way he explains it, he has a number of these, six of these antitheses where he'll say, you know, you've heard it said, you shall not murder, but I say, don't get angry with somebody. You've heard it said, don't commit adultery. I say, don't even lust after a woman in your heart. The things that he specifies are all things that are not these things. I'm talking about kosher and festivals and your ox goring somebody. So he doesn't, you know, for example, he doesn't say, you know, you've heard it said, you shall be circumcised, but I say to you, he doesn't like make that more extreme. And so like, he's not taking these things and he's saying, you know, I've thought about it for years and years and years, and I don't know whether Matthew wants his Gentile followers to keep kosher and to keep Sabbath, and I don't know. I could see it either way.
Yeah, I know Dale Martin has the view that Matthew is in fact probably suggesting the Gentiles also follow the law as well. Okay, that's fine. Moving on to textual criticism of the Bible, if we may. Thank you. Do we have the original? Surely we must have, let me rephrase it this way, the written manuscripts of the Gospels, the letters of the Apostles, Paul, Peter, and John. We have them. I've got a Bible here that shows me the letters that they wrote.
Yeah.
One and two, Peter. So we must have them, surely.
Yeah. What's the problem? I wish we did. I wish we had any original writings from the ancient world. We don't have the original. So whoever wrote the book of Amos sat down one day and sort of wrote things. We don't have that thing that he wrote. And whoever wrote the Gospel of Mark sat down one day and he had sources available to him and he heard stories and he sat down and he wrote something. We don't have that thing he wrote. Books were not mass produced. There was no mechanical ways of reproducing them. Books to be circulated had to be copied by hand. Until the invention of the printing press in the 15th century. And so throughout all of antiquity down to the 15th century, copies were made of books and different people would make different copies. And that's true of the New Testament. And so we don't have Paul's letter to the Galatians that he wrote. We don't have the first copy made of it. We don't have the copy of the copy made of it. We don't have copies for, you know, for a very long time. We have more copies of the books of the New Testament than for any other book from the ancient world. It's not even close. We have lots more, but most of these copies of the New Testament that we have are from many centuries later. Most of them are from 1,000 years later and later. So that we don't have any, if you just take with Mark, for example, our earliest copy of Mark, if Mark was written in the year 70, the earliest surviving copy we have of Mark is not a complete copy. It has portions of 8 of the 16 chapters, just portions of these 8 chapters and none of the other 8. And it dates from around the year 200. So it's about 130 years after Mark.
We've got 50% of that gospel.
Not 50%. We've got portions. We've got about a third of it.
At what point then in history do we have 100% of the Gospel of Mark extant today that we can say, there it is?
First copy is in the middle of the 4th century. It's either Codex Sinaiticus or Codex Vaticanus from around the year 370. So the first complete copy we have of Mark is 300 years after Mark. So after that, we start getting copies, and we get more and more copies in the Middle Ages. So when you get to the Middle Ages, you know pretty well what people are reading when they're reading the Gospel of Mark, because you've got all these copies. But what did Mark look like before 370? or what did it look like in the year 150? Well, it's complicated, but this is what textual critics do. They try to figure out what the author wrote based on surviving copies that are all different from each other. So when I say they're all different from each other, the Mark that comes down to us has 16 chapters in it. Yes. And it's not that some Gospels of Mark would have had 24 chapters. You know, we're not thinking that somebody added 8 chapters or somebody took out, 3 chapters or anything like that. But there are, the last 12 verses in most Bibles of Mark were almost certainly added later by a scribe. The two manuscripts I just mentioned, the two oldest manuscripts we have, don't have the last 12 verses. And either do other sort of. So that's a big chunk. But most of the time we're talking about wording getting changed. So that somebody's copying Galatians 3:3 and he miscopies a word. Or he thinks like, oh, that word's wrong, and he changes the word. Or he adds a line, or he takes out a line, and you get lots and lots of that. Lots of it.
I just want to say for the viewers, this is one of my favorite books by Barth, The Orthodox Corruption of Scripture, The Effect of Early Christological Controversies on the Text of the New Testament. This is actually different from the point you're making. You're talking about just scribal errors, copying and whatever. Here, you're talking about deliberate, theologically motivated changes to the New Testament itself, to the manuscripts anyway, to further particular, Jesus couldn't have said that. He must have meant that. I'll change it here. Or Paul couldn't have said that. Must have meant something different. Yeah. And you identify quite a few Orthodox. In other words, this is what we would call the Christian church today when they changed the manuscript tradition.
Yeah, we can't get into a scribe's mind to know what he was thinking. They're all he's, by the way, that we know of it. They might have been some female scribes, but it's hard to tell. But we don't know what they were thinking. But there are some changes of our manuscripts that almost certainly are intentional. I mean, whoever added the last 12 verses of Mark, it wasn't by a slip of the pen. somebody thought, oh, I need to add this. And so we get things like that. My book, The Orthodox Corruption of Scripture, is about changes that affect how the Bible, how different passages of the Bible understand Christ. And so they involved with the Christological controversies of the 2nd and 3rd centuries, when you have controversies about is Jesus human and then he became God, or was he like all human the whole time, or was he God? Did he become a human? Is he God and not human? Is he human, not God? Is he like somehow two things? If he's two things, is he like 50% of each? What is he? And so these debates are going on, and it's interesting that scribes change their manuscripts in places that really affect the controversies and that appear to reflect the controversies. And so that's what my book is about, is how scribes would sometimes change the text to make it more amenable to the Orthodox understanding of Jesus.
Okay. Just moving on, if I would just change the subject slightly, the significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, I'm often told, I often hear from Christians who say, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they really took us much further back in time. We now got much earlier manuscripts, and it confirms the Old Testament we always had. It's the same books, the same content. Isaiah's just the same. Jeremiah's just the same. Is this true or not? I mean, what's really going on here? Or is it more complicated than that?
Yeah, no, it's a very important thing. The Dead Sea Scrolls are hugely important for all sorts of reasons. Not just the copies of the Bible, by the way, but also they tells us a lot about this group of Jews who were in these kind of monastic like communities, the Essenes. But some of the Dead Sea Scrolls are biblical manuscripts, and they were a huge find. The reason is because the Hebrew Bible that we use today, the people who use the Hebrew Bible actually in Hebrew and that are translating the Hebrew Bible, are basing their translations on a manuscript that was written around the year 1000 of the Common Era. Around 1000 of the Common Era. It came from Leningrad, and so it's called Codex Leningradensis. Jewish scribes in the Middle Ages, when they copied a manuscript, they would destroy it because now they had a perfect copy of it, and they made sure the copy was perfect. They had ways of doing that through the Middle Ages. The problem is, what were scribes doing before the Middle Ages, before they had these rules? Well, we had to guess that they were getting it right. And so the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947, and they include portions of every book of the Hebrew Bible except for the book of Esther. Esther? Yeah. Because it turns out God is not named in Esther, and so that for some reason that book's not among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Most of the scrolls we have are not complete scrolls. The Isaiah scroll is virtually a complete scroll, and it is very, very close in wording to the Codex Leningradensis.
Right. So that confirms the Bible we have today was historically transmitted.
No. It's got nothing to do with it. And so I need to explain several things here because there's several points that some people like overlook. Which is the first point people overlook. That's true of the Isaiah scroll, but it's not true of other Dead Sea scrolls. There are other Dead Sea scrolls. The scroll of Jeremiah that we have has differences from our Jeremiah, and the differences from our Jeremiah are like the differences that come to us from the Greek translation of Jeremiah in the Septuagint, in the Greek Bible. That version of Jeremiah is 15% shorter than the Leningradensis. 15%! So that's not very accurate. So it's not that everything is like the Isaiah scroll. The Isaiah scroll is like the Isaiah scroll, but it doesn't prove.
That's one that's always mentioned, always showcased. Oh, look at Isaiah. Isaiah is exactly the same. Look at the perfection of transmission, the reliability.
So that's my first point. That this manuscript of Isaiah was written 1,000 years before Leningradensis. It's accurate, but the others are not the same. Exactly. Second point, Isaiah the prophet was writing. Isaiah of Jerusalem was living in the 8th century BCE. That means we don't have any manuscripts for the first over 700 years. So the fact that you have a manuscript that from, say the year 1 to the year 1000, you can show that Isaiah was copied accurately. But our question is, what about between the year 700 BCE and 1? No, there's 700 years. We have no evidence. In Hebrew, no Hebrew text. So you can't say this is exactly what Isaiah wrote. How would you know how much it got changed between 700 and the Dead Sea Scroll copy? There's no way to know. There are ways, not good ways. So that's second. Third thing, even if we had everything that was accurate in either any book of the New Testament or the New Testament or Old Testament, even if we had a manuscript, even if we had the original, suppose we had the original of Mark, or suppose we had the original of Joshua, we have the original, that would have no bearing on the question of whether it's accurate or not. Mm-hmm. It would only have a bearing on whether we know what the author wrote. So the way I usually illustrate this is we have millions of copies of Mein Kampf, and they are accurate. They, I mean, they might not be accurate with what Hitler actually wrote, but they don't have any differences. We know what the first printed copy looked like. Does that mean that it's accurate? No! It doesn't mean that it's right. It just means you know what he wrote. The fact you know what somebody wrote doesn't mean that what they wrote is right. That's a different thing. So those are three really big points that shows that this argument just doesn't hold. And any one of those three shows that they didn't hold. Three together, forget it.
The fact is it not worse than that? Because we give the example of Isaiah. It's now commonly accepted that, yeah, maybe the first 39 chapters of Isaiah were written by this prophet in Isaiah from downtown Jerusalem. But it was added to by maybe a second scribe or maybe a third scribe or scribes. Yeah. So we don't even if we were to dig up the book of Isaiah that we have it today from 500 years ago or 600 years ago, it doesn't mean we have the prophet Isaiah's own words, which many scholars think were added to anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's very common to think that Isaiah, and there's really good reason for this, Isaiah of Jerusalem wrote most of chapter 1 to 39, and then someone 150 years later wrote 40 to 55, then the other 56 and on. And so, you know, it's a compilation no matter what. But even if you have Isaiah's words, again, it doesn't mean that he's right. He might be right. I mean, but that's a different question. The fact you have an accurate manuscript is not evidence that what the person said is accurate.
Okay, that's fair enough. We can perhaps move on to the last part then. Christianity after the New Testament, or Christianities after the New Testament. You've written a superb book here, After the New Testament, A Reader in Early Christianity, published by Oxford University Press, which is a wonderful anthology of texts from the early centuries of the church, or the churches, I suppose. Just to clarify a few things, the traditional picture one we get from the church historian Eusebius, for example, is that Jesus founded the church. The disciples were the pillars of the church. They went out, preached the message with Paul, and you know, yeah, the church encountered heretics and problem groups and so on, what you might call the Ebionites or the Marcionites or the Gnostic or whatever you want to call them. But basically, Christ founded the church, and it went through time, through history, right up to the present day. But do we not now know that we see Jewish Christianity, we've got churches founded by Paul, we've got the Ebionites, we've got Marcion in the second century, and these are quite a wide spectrum of different Christian groups, all identifying as Christian. You know, these are people who believe what they believe is true. Firstly, this is astonishing, isn't it, when you really get the sense of the diversity, the big differences between these Christian groups. And my second question connects to that. Which of these early movements most closely resembles, do you think, the faith of Jesus' own disciples, if it's possible to make that connection?
Yeah, so again, it's a very complicated issue. And it's Eusebius, as many of you here will know, is known as the father of church history. He's the first one to write a sketch of the history of Christianity from the time of Jesus up to his own day, around the year 300, so the first 300 years of Christianity. And he has a lot of motifs driving his work, as he describes a lot of earlier authors and a lot of earlier views. He talks about persecutions and martyrdoms and heresies, and he gives the history of the church leaders. His view of the relationship of heresy and orthodoxy. Orthodoxy for him would mean the correct belief, the true faith that people in his day had. And heresy would be a false teaching of some kind. His view was that Jesus taught orthodoxy to his disciples, taught the basically what we would think of as the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed. He taught the truth to his disciples, who passed it down to their successors, And there's always been this main body of truth that has been the mainstream the whole time. It's always been the majority opinion. And every now and then you get some heretic coming along who is willful or mean-spirited or inspired by a devil.
He's motivated by bad intentions. They're never good guys, just got a different idea. They're always malicious individuals, I've noticed.
They're malicious and demon-inspired. And they come up with something like, they'll say, oh, actually, there are two gods. There's not one God, you know, or there are 36 gods, or salvation isn't by Christ's death. Jesus didn't even die. You know, and these are all offshoots. They're secondary offshoots from the mainstream that's always been there in Eusebius's presentation. That view of Eusebius held all the way up to the beginning of the 20th century. This is just what church historians said. So if you read a church historian from the 19th century, this is how they'll paint what happened in early Christianity. It all changed in the 1930s with the publication by a German scholar named Walter Bauer, who wrote a book that his English translation is called Orthodoxy and Heresy in Earliest Christianity. Bauer argued that if you actually look at the surviving evidence region by region, so you look, you go to Egypt and you look at our oldest records of what Christianity was like in Egypt, or you go to Antioch up in Syria, or you go to Asia Minor, you go to these places where we actually have records, the earliest records in almost every place is something that later was called a heresy. Bauer argued that, in fact, it wasn't that there was like this mainstream of orthodoxy with heretics coming off everywhere, that, in fact, there were lots of different groups of Christians as far back as we have records, and they were fighting for converts. And eventually one of the groups ended up winning out, and it got more converts, and it wiped out the opposition, and then it rewrote the history. And Eusebius is a rewritten version of what actually was the truth, which is that there was a wide diversity. So that's Bauer's view. He came out with this in 1934. Unfortunately, it wasn't translated into English until the late 1970s. So a lot of English and American scholars didn't pay enough attention to it. But it has become a very much the critical opinion of the critical historians today. And it's interesting that archaeological discoveries have in almost every instance verified what he had to say. For example, the discovery of the Nag Hammadi Library in 1945, just a year and a half before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Nag Hammadi Library, or the Gnostic Gospels, as they're sometimes called, which, every time there's some kind of gospel that shows up, it's always something that is not orthodox. recently, for example, the Gospel of Judas.
Yeah.
And so it looks like in early Christianity there were these various views of things, and you can trace the diversity actually back into the New Testament. Just as you were talking earlier about Matthew and Paul having different views of the law, that's a pretty significant difference. And everywhere, almost every time Paul writes a letter, he's got these Christian enemies. he has more enemies than friends, and that's in his day. We don't have the writings of his enemies. wish we did. So the idea is it's very diverse all the way back. What would be the form that would be most like the view of Jesus? Well, I suppose you mentioned the Ebionites. The Ebionites are, there might be several groups of Jewish Christians who remain Torah faithful. They keep the Torah. They're Jewish, or they're Jewish converts to Judaism, and they believe in being Jewish, keeping the Torah, and believing that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. Yeah. And that would be much closer to what Jesus himself said than what the Gnostics were saying, or what Marcion was saying, or what the Orthodox people ended up saying. So the irony is that the group that's probably most in alignment with, say, the teachings of Peter and James, and then Jesus himself, is the group that got declared a heresy.
Right. So the irony is the faith of the original disciples ultimately got branded as a heresy in the Christian church. This is the irony of history, surely.
Yeah. It's an irony of history that keeps replicating itself, because as time goes on, in the second century, you have Orthodox theologians who have views that become the standard view that later, centuries later, become declared a heresy. Origen in the third century is an opponent of Orthodoxy, gets declared a heretic, and it's just it's how Christianity developed over time.
To clarify one point, which some may be confused about, surely we can just look at the letters that Peter himself wrote, 1 and 2 Peter in the Bible. Surely we can just look at 1, 2, and 3 letters of John. Look, they're by John, the Apostle John. My Bible says they're by the Apostle John. These are Christians, this is mainstream Orthodox Eusebian views, the views that Eusebius would have approved of. Yeah. So surely this is a problem for your thesis.
Right. So, here's another thing about critical scholars in the New Testament. we have most of the books in the New Testament are named after an apostle in one way or another. Some of those books are actually anonymous. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John don't claim to be written by people named Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're anonymous. The authors don't tell us who they are. But later people said they're written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There are other books that claim to be written by people. First Peter claims to be written by Peter. Second Peter claims to be written by Peter.
An eyewitness. So 2 Peter actually says, he actually says in chapter 2, I think, I was there. I witnessed these things. I saw them, the life of Jesus, the transfiguration. So clearly, the eyewitness testimony in 2 Peter.
Scholars are pretty convinced, and except for very conservative evangelical Christian scholars, scholars as a rule are convinced that 2 Peter was not written by the same person as wrote 1 Peter. And the reason is because the writing style is extremely different. Not different in the way that you and I might write, you know, one letter one way and write a different letter, but different in a way that this is not the same author. It'd be kind of like reading, you know, James Joyce and Mark Twain and thinking, yeah, okay, these probably are not the same guy. But, and there are lots of other reasons. Whoever wrote 2 Peter was claiming to be Peter, even though he wasn't.
You're saying this is a forgery? Are you saying 2 Peter is a forgery?
I call it a forgery. I mean, because that's what it is. Ancient people debated.
I didn't write a book about it, by the way. Forgery. I'm plugging not your more popular work, but this book, which is the more academic work, which is much better book this than the other one. The Rise of the Use of Literary Deceit in Early Christian Polemics. And what I found interesting is that maybe it's still the case, maybe you can clarify, it was a popular view, at least in English-speaking scholarship that I've read, that, look, this is not a problem. Look, Peter, people were honoring Peter's memory. They were writing in his tradition, like a school of Petra, a Petrine school. So they weren't falsifying his name. They weren't writing forgery. Oh, no. This was a recognized literary convention in the ancient world. Now, what you've done in this critically acclaimed book, the reviews on the back from top scholars who specialize in this area speak for themselves, including someone called Dale Martin. I think he's a mate of yours, but anyway, well, apart from one mate of yours, no, he's also a specialist. No, is that this clearly debunks the whole idea, doesn't it? It shows there's absolutely no evidence that this was an accepted literary convention, that you could write in someone else's name, a famous person. That was perfectly okay.
Yeah. Well, we all learned that when we were in graduate school or seminary, that was okay. And that, as an act of humility, I'm not the great Apostle Paul, but this is what he would have said if he were alive now. So I'll put it in his name because I don't want to claim any credit for that. And so we all learned that. We learned that in philosophical schools they would do that if you're not really Socrates, you claim to be Socrates or whatever. And so I looked into it. I've spent a long time. I looked up every reference I could find in every Greek and Latin reference I could find to this phenomenon. And there's a lot of evidence. There's a lot of discussion of it in the ancient world. And it is not approved. I talked for a very long time about this to show that, in fact, ancient people condemned this as a practice. I have a lot of people, even scholars, every time they evaluate it, they condemn it. I've had a lot of people tell me, even scholars tell me, well, people wouldn't do it if it was condemned. I mean, okay, how well do you know human nature? Are you kidding me? You mean people don't do things that other people say you shouldn't do?
Okay. It's a beautifully naive argument, isn't it? It's almost touching in its naivety. Oh, they were Christian. No, you see why? Because I get this today. These are Christians. They're good folk. They would never do it. That's the kind of the logic. When thinking, do you know any Christians? I mean, do you know anything about human nature?
Well, I actually, at the end of my book, I do explain how I imagine they rationalize it to themselves. Because I think, it's the ancient world. In the ancient world, when they talked about this practice of writing a book, they weren't speaking English, so they didn't use the word forgery, but they did use other words that are similarly condemning. Most commonly, they were just called pseudoi, which means lies. A book like that was called a lie. Or they were called notha. Nothon was an illegitimate child. And it's because the author is not who you think he is. And so it's an illegitimate. So the father isn't who you think it is. And so it's an illegitimate child. And it has all the connotations of like nasty words meaning illegitimate children in English. And so they were not calling these things nice things. So Second Peter, even the 4th century, a famous church teacher named Didymus the Blind in Alexandria said that it was an othon. It was a, it was It wasn't written by Peter. And so you get a lot of that. And the thing is, in the New Testament, there scholars today are pretty much agreed that the first, second Peter, certainly not. But there are a lot of, I go through my book, six letters of Paul are doubted by most scholars today as not being by Paul, even though they claim to be written by Paul. And first, second, third John are probably not written by first, and so on.
Just a quick point. I mean, it's not really an issue that just for the sake of the record, really. Christians often say that 2 Peter explicitly used, the author says that there was a secretary involved. So could not be, like an analogy was given to me once by a Catholic priest, like contemporary, as anachronistic, I know, but contemporary papal encyclicals. The Pope writes an encyclical. Rarely, well, perhaps Ratzinger might be an exception, rarely do popes actually write these things themselves, because they're just the time or whatever. So why can't 2 Peter have been like a papal encyclical written in his name with his authorization, but someone else wrote it?
So the line is, it might be 1 Peter. I think it's maybe 1 Peter 5, but he says that he's writing this letter through Silvanus. Then the name Silvanus, so through Silvanus. And people say, see, so he's writing through somebody, which means he's using the secretary.
Yeah.
Actually, when you see how that phrase gets used, when somebody's writing a book, dia somebody, it means through, you can trace this through a lot of literature, which I talk about in my book. And it always means that that's the person who's the letter carrier. He's the person who's taking the letter. So you're writing it through another. I'm communicating through Silvanus, who's taking you the letter. I spend a lot of time, not a lot of time, I spend a number of pages talking about whether it's plausible that secretaries wrote 1 and 2 Peter or other books. And so, the idea would be that Peter dictated something to a secretary who wrote it down, or Peter said, this is what I want to say. Just, come up with something and send it off. Something like that. So I go through all of the evidence we have for secretaries in the ancient world and how secretaries functioned. And I show that they never functioned that way. We have no instance. We have discussions of secretaries in the ancient, we have people talking about their own secretaries, and secretaries talking about things, and people taking dictation talking about things. And it is never the case that somebody is composing a treatise in somebody else's name as the secretary.
Right.
The way secretaries worked was by dictation. And part of my argument in this book is that Peter almost certainly didn't know Greek. If he did know Greek, he didn't know how to compose in Greek, let alone, dictate composition in Greek. And so, this is not read by people.
Well, I love the way, I think in 2 Peter, he talks about participating in the divine nature, which is a lovely Hellenistic, metaphysical, philosophical term, very commonly used by Galilean fishermen in first century.
Yeah, exactly. Uneducated Galilean fishermen.
Maybe not.
Speak Aramaic.
Just to conclude that point, just my personal interest, your research is, I do commend you for this particularly for this book, I think is a model of fantastic scholarship. How has it been, I know it's been reviewed by some scholars, but has it been a game changer in the English-speaking world of scholarship, or has it just been ignored, or what? Or is it still too early to gauge the effect of this? So I know in German scholarship you say that this is accepted, but in the English-speaking world it hasn't been hitherto for, at least.
So I'll tell you, I've written a number of books for scholars, and they've all had gratifying receptions. I'm perplexed by this book. This is the only book in English that gives a full analysis of the phenomenon of pseudepigraphy in early Christianity.
Yeah,
it's the only one ever written. There are lots of people who write an entire book on the authorship of Colossians, or the authorship of Ephesians, or the authorship of whatever. I covered that, as you can see, it's a very big book. And it doesn't seem, people aren't reading it. Or they're not, it's like they're ignoring it. I don't know why.
Could it be then, if they are ignoring it then, I'm generally disappointed and sorry to hear that they are, because it's good scholarship. The only conclusion I can guess is that New Testament scholars is still dominated mostly, I think, by Christian believers. And your scholarship really doesn't fit with their worldview, and it's not really welcome. So maybe it's just been quietly ignored.
That could be it. But, you know, liberal Christians would have no problem with this. I mean, I believed a lot of this when I was still a Christian. And, you know, you mentioned Dale Martin. He's a practicing Christian.
No.
I had lots of friends who are Christians. I think people don't want to be bothered with actually getting down into the weeds. This book does get into the weeds. I mean, this book gets into the weeds more than any book I've ever written. It's the book I'm proudest of. I mean, this is like
really interesting.
Oh my God. And it's like it was so much work.
It is. I mean, I will tell you, I'm so privileged. I have actually read every word of this book. I'm not ashamed to boast. I haven't read the index. I didn't read every word of the index. But all of the narrative, every single note, I read it all because I really wanted to suck the juice, the marrow out of this subject. Yeah. So, and it is an academic book, and I do nevertheless recommend it extremely highly. It also presents really uncomfortable questions, perhaps not for liberal Christians, but for more traditional Christians about, you know, why are there forgeries in my New Testament? What do we do with that? It's a real explosive issue. Perhaps, as you say, not for Dale Martin and like-minded people, but for others, it certainly is.
You know, I do, but I do deal with it at the end, as you know, because I try to show that, you know, we have this idea that lying is always wrong. And what I show in this book is that that idea, weirdly to most people, that idea did not come about until Augustine.
I was going to say, Augustine is really hot on lies. He goes on and on about it. He said, you cannot lie under any circumstances. You can't lie.
You could, you know, if you're going to save your child from torture, you cannot lie in order to make it happen. You can't do it. Right. And so, like, oh my God, really? And he wrote two treatises on this. He's very strong on this. And
I know. It's quite extraordinary because, anyway, we're going to Augustine's views on life.
But that was Augustine's view. The reason he had to come out so strongly is because most Christians didn't think that. Most Christians, and we have account, of course, Christians think it's okay to lie sometimes. If you have to lie to save somebody's life, of course you're going to lie. And there are a lot of lies.
So your wife says, does my ex look big in this? No, dear, it looks lovely. You
exactly. And but even in the Bible, people lie.
Oh dear, take it off and put a sack on. You don't say that. You say, "Yeah, you look lovely, dear."
Right? Exactly. No, people lie, and in the Bible, there are lies, and people justified lying in early Christianity. And there are sometimes reasons to lie, and for most people who lie, the ends justify the means.
The means, yeah.
And if you've got a truth that is really, really important that you want to convey and you want people to read it, then you write in somebody else's name. And so that's why I, you know, wrote this book and signed it Richard Dawkins.
Oh, controversial. Bringing his anyway, the final question, we got 15 minutes left, is actually an academic question. So I've written it down because I want to get the nuance right, so forgive me, but over the past two decades or so, the criteria approach to the historical Jesus has increasingly been seen as problematic. You know, this is a criteria of multiple attestation and so on. You know what the criteria are, obviously. Dale Allison, a fellow American academic in New Testament studies, in his book Constructing Jesus, also expresses dissatisfaction with the criteria approach, arguing that many times good arguments can be made for and against authenticity of a particular passage using the criteria approach, he argues. Instead, he advocates a more generalist approach whereby we consider an element as probably authentic if it is present in multiple genres, like parables, narrative, miracle stories, apocalyptic material, etc. It seems the main objection is that the problem of subjectivity with the criteria, only the criterion of multiple independent attestation seems to escape the clutches of subjectivity, but it does not necessarily indicate authenticity of material, and we are not always confident in knowing whether or not we are indeed dealing with independent sources anyway. So the question is, but what is your assessment of this situation today? And is there really a better way forward to venture behind the Gospels? So this is a purely a scholarly question.
Yeah, well, as you might imagine, I have a lot to say about it. And good. So I don't know if your listeners will know what the criteria are. Should I explain them briefly?
Yeah, perhaps briefly. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so, yeah, So the criteria, so different historians of the historical Jesus have different criteria they use. Two of the most common are what you're saying, multiple independent attestation. The idea is that if you've got multiple sources that say something similar about Jesus independently of one another, so they haven't gotten it from each other. So, for example, that Jesus has brothers. You know, you get Jesus' brothers in Mark, and John doesn't seem to have used Mark, and so he also has the brothers, and Paul mentions the brothers, and you get the brothers in Acts, and so, you know, so these are independent, they all mention brothers. Well, that makes it more likely Jesus had brothers. Whereas if you've got something that's found in only one source, it may be authentic, but you don't really, you know, it's not good evidence if it's only one source. Like the parable of the Good Samaritan, it's in Luke. And so, well, you know, maybe Jesus said it, but you can't prove he said it. You don't have much evidence because maybe Luke made it up, you know, or something like that. So multiple independent helps establish what probably happened. The second one, people call by various things, and sometimes they differentiate, but sometimes it's called the criterion of dissimilarity. Sometimes it's called the criterion of embarrassment. Sometimes people differentiate between those two. But the basic idea is that if you've got something in the Gospels that sure looks like something a Christian writer would not want to say about Jesus, then probably he's saying it because it's something that happened rather than something that he made up.
We mentioned Mark 10 earlier on, Mark 10, 17, 18, where Jesus apparently denies either he's God or he's good. And this was so embarrassing to their later evangelist, Matthew, that he changed the words of Jesus to remove that problem. So there we have an example of embarrassment and change.
That'd be an example. That's a good example. It's a good example. Mm. Or even something like Jesus getting baptized. People say, well, you know, in early Christianity, the person who's the spiritual superior baptized the inferior. So who would come up with that John the Baptist baptized Jesus? That showed that John the Baptist was superior to Jesus. No one's going to make that up. You know, So those are the two ones that people mainly talk about, but there's also things about, and it has to fit into this historical context, and there are various things. They've argued against these criteria, and so they're saying that they're unsatisfactory. And so let me tell you my point about my view of this, and then I'll tell you what I think about Dale Allison's view. Dale Allison, by the way, is one of the truly fine New Testament scholars in the world.
He's extraordinary man. I met him on this channel, and he's a lovely human being as well, to be honest.
He's the real deal. So I'm not going to disagree with him down the line, but I do have some basic disagreements. My view of this is that people have fetishized the criteria.
Right.
In ways that have become problematic, and people have recognized that they're problematic. But if you're going to do history, there is no objective method. And so you shouldn't say these are subjective as if there's some alternative. There is no alternative, because history is a subject. All of the humanities are subjective professions. My view of the criteria are, I don't know why more people haven't pointed this out, these criteria are how everybody figures out what happened in the past. It's just they don't call them these names. Suppose you're a criminal investigator. Suppose you're in a court case. You've got a court case, and somebody's on trial for, you know, stealing something from a store. And you've got five people who independently say, I saw him do it. That's good evidence. If you've got one person who said he did it, that's not as good. So you look for independent evidence, witnesses saying something.
Right.
Or suppose you've got somebody on the witness stand who's been questioned about the guy's alibi. And the person on the witness stand being questioned about the alibi is the guy's mother, his beloved mother, who would do anything for him. And their cross-examination, she admits that the alibi doesn't hold up. That's against what she would want to say. That means that probably the alibi does not hold up. That's the criterion of dissimilarity. And so this is just how we figure out what happened in the past. It doesn't matter if you're talking about Abraham Lincoln or Winston Churchill or Julius Caesar. You look for multiple sources. You hope that they're near the time. You hope they're independent of one another. They say if they corroborate each other's stories without collaborating, and if sometimes they say stuff that's absolutely not what the author wanted to say, or anybody who's, then that's more likely historical. Mm-hmm. But I do not think you can throw out the criteria without throwing out the possibility of doing history, period.
None.
I don't agree that multiple attestation is not subjective. It also is subjective for the reason that you mentioned. How do you know these sources are independent? Mm-hmm. You have to make an evaluation. Evaluation mm-hmm. means subjectivity. So Dale Allison's approach, I like very much. I think that it does get you to many of the very important things about Jesus. But I don't think that you can throw out the criteria, that you need to throw out the criteria. What people need, because you can get more than Dale Allison gets. And I think the deal is this. Doing history involves a probability judgment. Mm. Always involves a probability judgment. Mm. I think that it is virtually certain that Joseph Biden won the election.
Well, hang on. There is Americans who would not agree with you, I'm afraid.
Exactly. It's a probability. And the fact is, you can show it. I think Obama was born in America. I think that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. I think that Julius Caesar was assassinated. I mean, I think these are probability judgments. I think we landed on the moon. But you can find people who say no. And it's because you can't prove it. You can't prove it because history is not like chemistry. Mm-hmm. Chemistry, you can repeat the experiment over and over and over again. You're going to get the same result if you control the variables. You'll get the same result. What that does in chemistry is it allows you then to predict what will happen next. In history, we're not predicting what's going to happen next. We're trying to figure out what happened before, and you can't repeat the experiment. So you have other kinds of evaluation. The evaluations are not meant to prove in a scientific way. They're meant to establish more probability. And some things are more probable than others. And so that's what you do. And you can't do it statistically. You can't say, well, this is 93% probable. It's just like, you know, it's fuzzier than that. But there are a lot of things about Jesus that you can say that are really highly probable. And other things that are pretty probable. And some things I think you can say for certain, highly probable, probable, kind of probable, yeah, not so probable, possible, yeah, maybe, yeah, not so much. And so you kind of, you know, you got to scale. And yeah, that's how I think you have to do it.
I think that's very helpful. Thank you for that. I think one of the things I've noticed when you read different biblical scholars, so you read, I don't know, Tom Wright, and then you read Jimmy Dunn, and then you read you or Dale Martin, or the list goes on and on and on, is it very often scholars assert their confidence that this is the case, that this particular passage is authentic. No, that passage, now this is how we, this is the correct historical recap. No, this is what Jesus really, no, this, and they say it with such absolute confidence. And yet, and this is the kicker, they all disagree with each other. I mean, on everything, but on very often on key passages. And I think maybe what Dale Allison, not Dale Martin, is reacting against his overconfidence, on behalf of historians who confidently assert, and yet they're all disagreeing with each other. Where the layman's left with bewildering range of Christologies and reconstruction of the historical Jesus using criteria which are supposed to give us results? How can this be the case? So you're simply advocating a much more humble, keep the criteria, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, we've got to have something, we've got to do history, but we're dealing with probabilities rather than this is the case and this is the case and everyone disagrees with what is the case.
Yeah, I completely agree. And Dale Allison's very good with that. You know, he admits what he doesn't know and he admits what the problems are. He's very good with that. You know, and I wrote a book on the historical Jesus, too. It was my first general audience book. And basically, I try, what upsets me about what most of the authors do is they lay this stuff out and they say these certainty things, but they don't show you how they got there. And, you know, I tried to show like how I got there. And my view of Jesus is really very close to Dale Allison's view. We both understand Jesus as an apocalypticist. You know, it's very similar, even though we take slightly different paths. But I think that You know, a lot of the Jesus scholars, they just throw stuff off, and you just say, oh, where are they coming up with that? You know,
there's an uncanny tendency for the religious convictions and the Christology of the writer to end up in the pages of the book they're writing about the historical Jesus. And Jesus ends up being pretty much in alignment with what the author himself actually believes about Jesus in the first place.
It's quite amazing. And especially
what a coincidence. So Tom writes Jesus, looks remarkably like the sort of Jesus that an Anglican Christian theologian will quite happily believe in. But it's not the case with Dale Allison, actually. He mentions this point, that his Jesus is not the kind of Jesus, perhaps, that he would have wished to have been the case. Yeah. If he had believed in that Jesus.
Me either. I mean, I think the Jesus that I think is historical is not the one I would want. It's very interesting, though, you know, because what people typically do is they start off describing Jesus by talking about Albert Schweitzer, who says that every generation of scholars paints Jesus in its own image. And then they say, so we don't want to do that. But then by the time you get to the end of the book, it's exactly that. Especially in the 80s, it was so funny in the 80s and 90s. Yeah. You know, all these Jesus books by these guys who grew up in this, they're all guys who grew up, these guys I'm talking about, who all grew up in the 60s and were countercultural types. And Jesus ends up being this countercultural type.
A hippie. Yeah. And guess what? Marxist historians ended up with a Jesus who was a counter revolutionary, who was remarkably like Che Guevara, actually. What are the chances of that? And Giza Vermish, the great Jewish historian at Oxford here, his Jesus ended up being pretty like a sage, charismatic, rabbinical teacher figure, pretty much like Giza Vermish himself, actually. anyway, Giza Vermish did some amazing work on Jesus the Jew, of course. Okay, well, we're running out of time now. So I don't want to cut you short, but in the remaining few minutes, do you have anything you just wanted to add or elaborate on what you said so far?
No, these are really interesting topics. And I was thinking, you know, I'm 66 now. I'm kind of thinking back with my stuff. And the stuff I've been interested in are things we've covered. You know, I think my whole career has really been about the text, the manuscripts of the New Testament and how they're varied from each other, and Jesus as an apocalyptic prophet and how you use the Gospels to get to the apocalyptic, and the diversity of early Christianity. Those are all things that it's right on for me. I would like to say for your hearers, though, that if they don't know, that I have a blog where I talk about all this stuff all the time. So if they'll just look up the Bart Ehrman blog, I raise money for charity. People have to pay a small membership fee to be on, but I don't make a dime myself. I give it all away to charity dealing with hunger and homelessness. But I post 5 times a week, like 1,400 words a day, 5 times a week, and I've been doing it since 2012 with archives. People can see. So, like, if people are interested in this stuff, you know, they should think about, just look up Bart Ehrman blog, and they'll see what's available.
No, that's a good idea. So, I meant to ask you, I forgot. Are you working on any projects now in terms of books that you're writing?
I just finished So, you know, I tend to have multiple things going on. I've got a book coming out in April from Yale University Press that deals with journeys to the afterlife. So people in the Christian tradition, people being given guided tours of heaven and hell, starting with the apocalypse of Peter outside the New Testament, almost made it in the New Testament, going up through the 5th and 6th centuries, and what these tell us about how people understood not just heaven and hell, but how they understood their world and what was important in life. And but I just finished a trade book a week ago for a broad audience on the book of Revelation. And how most people avoid Revelation because it's too weird and bizarre and they can't figure it out. The only people who really pay attention to Revelation, most of the people who pay attention to it, are people who think it's predicting our near future. That's a blueprint for what's going to happen.
Well, Americans seem to quite like it. Yeah.
I mean, love that stuff. They love it. But even the Brits who read it tend to like it. And so I show in my book why that is completely what the problem is with that reading, that reading is not the way to read Revelation. And then I spend a good part of the book talking about what Revelation really does tell us. And about important things, not just like what it's just not like not technical interpretation, but like what its view of God and the world and humans is. And it's actually rather disturbing.
It's a fascinating text. Great. Well, that's very, I look forward to reading that. Well, thank you very much indeed, Dr. Bart Ehrman, for your time. And I'm sure the audience will have learned a great deal. I do recommend just a quick couple of recommendations. There's not the latest edition, but Bart's New Testament, the New Testament, an historical introduction to the early Christian writings is, I think, is one of the textbooks that are used in university. I do recommend that, along with Forgery, Counter Forgery, and The Orthodox Corruption of Scripture. These are the more scholarly works. I know there are other more popular ones, but I'm not going to mention them because they always get mentioned. I want to mention something else for a change. So thank you very much indeed, Bart, for your time. Enjoy your time in London. I hope, because I know you're here in London with us. And happy holidays, as they say.
Okay. Thanks. You too. Thanks.
You too. Thank you. Till next time.